fleeting glimpses of things seen through a veil, darkly. Do we understand the meaning of these visions of life? Why we are here and how little of our existence we truly understand? Tonight we will talk of these things on The Other Side. Well, welcome to The Other Side. Thank you for being a Plus member in our Plus Club. We appreciate it very much. And what I like to do on these programs is also bring in some people we've talked to from the past, from other podcasts. One of the people that I certainly want to get on this program was Gary Lachman. And he recently has done a fascinating biography on Carl Jung. And really delves into the idea of Jung the mystic, and this idea that this famous psychologist was much more into the other side, as it were, than we would ever possibly imagine. Gary Lachman is one of today's most widely read and respected writers on the esoteric and occult themes. His writing has been published in several national journals on philosophy and modern culture, and his books include Rudolf Steiner, Politics and the Occult, Turn Off Your Mind, and A Secret History of Consciousness. And these have been published to acclaim both in America and Europe. In his famous musical career, Gary has been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a founding member of the pioneer rock band Blondie. Gary was born in New Jersey and currently lives in London. Gary, welcome back to our program. So glad to be able to talk to you about this book today.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, and thanks for having me on again.
And before we get started, we were discussing the title of this program a little bit, and you told me a great joke. So could you share that with us? Because I think that's kind of humorous.
All right. Well, it goes, why did the spiritualist cross the road?
I don't know.
To get to the other side. There you go.
I can't believe I've never heard that before.
It's little known that all those chickens were actually spiritualists as well.
So. That's right. There's a thought process there. Anyhow, let's talk a little bit about Carl Jung. You think of he did extensive work for several years, I believe, with Freud. I've never really thought of him as a mystic per se. Why did he catch your attention?
Well, I mean, I first started reading Jung in my teens, many, many years ago in the 1970s. And in fact, the fact that that's how I came across him tells us something about Jung's mystical sort of career, because he in the late 50s, very early 60s, he died in 1961. Actually, this is the 50th anniversary year of his death this year. He was picked up by sort of what was the burgeoning counterculture. He certainly had a much more popular grassroots appeal than in the, say, scientific or the mainstream psychoanalytic or psychiatric community. And I'd read him in the context of people like D.T. Suzuki on Zen and Kerouac and Ginsberg and the Beats and Carlos Castaneda and other people at the time that were in this kind of, Hermann Hesse was another one, a contemporary of Jung. It was this sort of countercultural canon of works at the time that, aspiring hippies, I guess, or late hippies, as I was, were expected to read. And the thing with Jung is that he was always interested in what you call the other side. He was always interested in what we call the paranormal, the psychic, the spiritual, the supernatural. He came from a family that was pretty much saturated in that. But he maintained throughout his career that he was not a mystic, and maintained equally as sternly that he was a scientist. And he, in his early days, he did start out doing some very sound, strict scientific work when he was at the Bergoldsli Clinic in Zurich in the early 20th century with word association tests and a variety of clinical experiments and practices. And then he became, as you said, pretty much Freud's bulldog in the early days of psychoanalysis. But all during that time and during his whole life, he had this other side to his interests that was deeply steeped in what we call the mystical. And the main kind of question in my book that I pursue is, why did Jung have this ambivalence? Why did he have this kind of, for the most of his career, a kind of, not necessarily secret, but he played his occult cards pretty close to his chest, and to the public at large, he presented himself and emphasized adamantly that he was a scientist. But meanwhile, he had this other side as well. And if you look at Jung's life, you'll see that there is this duality in quite a few different things. And so this was the interest to me. Like, what was it? Why didn't Jung come out, more openly earlier in his career about his interests in these sort of thing and so on?
Now, one of the reasons that perhaps he had let this dual life, as you say, is if he had fully exposed to his colleagues his interest in this area and fully played it to the hilt, wouldn't have he been pretty much ostracized?
Well, he was actually in many ways. I mean, this was this is what happened when he broke with Freud in around 1912, 1913, after being Freud's staunchest colleague and supporter for at least half a dozen years, and he was in line to inherit the throne, as it were.
Right.
Freud had sort of primed him to, he was the crown prince. He was the one who was going to lead psychoanalysis into the next sort of generation and so on, because Freud, rightly so, recognized Jung's brilliance. I mean, Jung had come upon his own way of grasping the reality of what Freud and others and what we call the unconscious mind prior to his contact with Freud. It was precisely because he had already had some evidence of it that he was highly stimulated and intrigued by Freud's work. They both seemed to be pioneers or explorers, looking at the same sort of unmapped territory. But as I said, Jung always had this interest in this other side. And while Freud Freud wanted psychoanalysis to be a science, and he himself was, you can consider him a reductive materialist scientific approach to the psyche, the unconscious. He was very much, very critical, dismissive of religion, and as we know, he would, the sort of caricature Freudian move is to sort of reduce religious or spiritual feelings to, sort of early toilet training or anal anxiety or something along those lines, and it was precisely that sort of thing that Jung couldn't accept, and because he knew there was something more, that you couldn't reduce all of the religious and spiritual and metaphysical yearnings that humans have had for centuries to this kind of crude sort of basis that Freud was presenting. But so he knew there was something more, and he continued all during the years that he worked with Freud to pursue these interests. When he started writing his the book Symbols of Transformation that basically made his reputation and also caused the rift with Freud, a lot to do had to do with mythology, and this is when he begins to develop the notion of the collective unconscious.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you about. Yeah. Is this idea of tapping into a greater mind, I guess, shared by all people, and talk about archetypes and things like that.
Yes. Yeah, well, he started to recognize that in some of his patients and some of the case histories he was studying, that these motifs, these themes, these symbols, these kind of patterns were emerging in the dreams and sort of fantasies of these patients that, to Jung at least, they seemed clearly parallel with, the great sort of mythologies and religious ideas of the past. And his patients couldn't have had any access to these sorts of things, he concluded. And so where were they coming from? They didn't sort of consciously absorb them and start spitting them out again. They came from some deeper layer of the psyche. And that same deeper layer of the psyche is the one that is more or less responsible or sort of the source or a link to, the other side, to the paranormal and the mystical and so on. And he tried to sort of kind of keep, you know, two things. Again, this is another sign of the dualism, and it's not when you recognize this going on in Jung's life, it's no surprise that a great deal of his work has to do with reconciling the opposites. You know, even from early on in his career up until his more mystical explorations into alchemy and so on, there's this idea of taking these two opposite realities and bringing them together and fusing them into something new, something that's new and emerges from both. And he tried to do that early on by trying to maintain being Freudian, but also not injuring his own interests and his own pursuits and his own insights. And it didn't really work. I mean, in the end, he basically came out in the book to say, like, well, you know, Freud's theory about the sexual basis of neuroses and so on is good as far as it goes, but it simply can't cover these sorts of things. And then
right.
That's when he starts arguing. And when he did that, that's when he became, he was excommunicated more or less from the Freudian sort of circle and kicked out. And then this is when he went through his famous crisis.
And if you think about Jung, a lot of things that we use is shorthand now, and probably not correctly half of the time, are the concepts of introversion, extroversion, mm-hmm. the idea of the complex. You know, you have a complex about something.
Yeah.
And another thing that he did some work on synchronicity, which has always fascinated me.
Yeah. Well, that's a later theme in Jung's, although it was something that, again, this is something that he was interested in. And you can say studied for many, many years before he came out in the open about it and talked about it. He starts, he in 1950 or 51, he writes a book with Wolfgang Pauli, a German physicist, and on this notion of synchronicity. And shorthand definition of synchronicity is the whole experience of meaningful coincidence, where, you know, you have a dream about something and the next day it's precisely, you know, the event of your dream, or you think about something and then suddenly you hear it on the television or something like that. And again, it's more than just coincidence. It has something very much to do with your life situation at the time. So it's the coincidence of two events, but it's meaningful in the sense that it somehow makes sense and it has something to do with what's going on in your life. And this is something, these sort of serendipitous events for something that Jung had noticed and saw in dreams and so on and so on, but he didn't come out to talk about it openly until the 1950s. And you say complexes. Now, this was Jung's early contribution to psychoanalysis, this notion that there are these kind of clusters of emotions or feelings that, in a way, have a mind of their own in our own psyche. And he came to understand this through his work with word association tests, where, you know, he would say a list of words, and then his client or his patient or whatever he was working with would react to them. And Jung would notice that on certain kinds of words, the person would have a strong reaction. They would hesitate, or they wouldn't know what to say, or they would change their mind. And often he discovered that the person doing that didn't even know that they had that sort of reaction. They themselves were unaware of this kind of little snag in their psyche. And so Jung came to the notion, this idea of complexes. But strangely enough, he had already encountered something like that in these series of seances that he participated in his early years. And in fact, he wrote his doctoral dissertation on what he called the pathology of so-called occult phenomena, in very, you know, academic, scientific, detached prose, where he sort of erases his own participation in the events. But they were family affairs. It was him, his cousins, his mother. They've been going on for quite some time. I say that Jung sort of grew up in this kind of paranormal right. family. His mother, she had visions when she was a child. And she would have a kind of dual personality where she would suddenly start talking in this strange other voice, saying, you know, very odd things, completely different than the kind of, you know, average everyday Swiss housewife that she was. And Jung's, her father, Jung's maternal grandfather, he himself, he was a preacher, and he believed in the reality of spirits. He used to keep a empty seat at the dinner table for the spirit of his first wife, who was deceased. and he would have conversations with her, much to the consternation of his living second wife, who was at the table as well. And then Jung's mother, when Samuel, her father, Jung's grandfather, was writing his sermons, Jung's mother, she had to sort of stay around him, shooing the spirits away from him, because he believed the spirits were around him, trying to sort of, you know, interfere with what he was writing, to slip a kind of, you know, a bad word in there or two or something like that in the sermon. And so Jung grew up in this whole sort of context. But when you read his dissertation about these seances that he was involved with his cousin, who was in love with him at the time, there's no indication that these aren't just people that he somehow, you know, picked out and just observed scientifically. There isn't this, you know, he doesn't let you know right. that this is a close family sort of thing. So again, there's a duality in there. But the reason I brought that up is the same sort of phenomena that he experienced in these seances with these voices and these kind of sort of semi-independent intelligences that would emerge during the seances. They were very much like the complexes that he discovered later with the word association test. So the two sorts of things, his spiritual, we could say, or paranormal pursuits, and his scientific ones, seem to be pointing him in the same direction. And I think you're absolutely right that Jung, you know, even if when you look back at that time when Jung was, this is the early 20th century, this is 1900, 1905, and so on, even though then broad scientific intellectual interest in things like mediumship and the paranormal and spiritualism was not unknown. People like the American psychologist and philosopher William James, who wrote mm-hmm. Classic Varieties of Religious Experiences, he openly, you know, studied mediums and psychic experiences. He was a member of the Society for Psychical Research. A few years later, the French philosopher Henri Bergson, who was one of the most famous people alive at the time, he's not as well known today, but he won the Nobel Prize and so on. He too openly investigated. So many other scientists and philosophers were investigating these things, but still, the sort of dominant theme was the kind of reductive, materialist, dismissive approach to it that is pretty much, you know, dominant today. You don't get too many well-known, you know, scientists or philosophers coming out and saying that they have, you know, they believe in the reality of these sorts of things. You get the Stephen Hawkings and the Richard right. Dawkins and all those coming right. out and basically beating a dead horse. We're supposed to have been cured of all these superstitions already for however many years, but they still feel like they have to come out and kick the horse around a few more times just to make sure it's dead.
Stephen Hawking just recently notably said that heaven is a fairy story meant for those afraid of the dark. So he just weighed in once again on that topic. On that topic.
What about blind people who believe in God, though?
That's true.
They're in the dark all the time, right?
That's true.
They shouldn't
That's
be
true.
Very That's afraid good... of it, right? So, I don't know.
That's
I mean,
true.
I,
That's
I,
true.
I, no, I, the thing about, I mean, I know, you know, in one sense, you know, he's the smartest man in the world and all that. He's our Einstein. But it bothers me that when they start to make these sort of ex cathedra pronouncements about everything and, you know, saying basically, oh, well, the universe just happened. You know, there's no...
Right.
You know, it's just like, oh, you know, okay, I don't know. But that to me, that, you know, that's as edifying,
exactly.
an answer as because, basically. So yeah. In any case, we're talking about Jung, not Hawking. So.
Right. No, but I agree. And the thing is that it just is almost in any field of endeavor. If you have somebody who is extremely well achieved in one area, and then they start making pronouncements about another area, that doesn't necessarily mean that expertise transfers over.
Sure.
But like if a doctor gives you legal advice, you know,
exactly.
Now, I mean, some people like yourself, you're very accomplished in music and very accomplished in this, but you put your time into this. You just didn't walk
well,
in.
Well, I mean, I'm certainly not going to make a pronouncement about some, you know,
right.
detailed, part of physics, but,
right.
But right. no, exactly. I was just thinking as you were saying this was that, you know, we know that Hawking, he talked earlier about, you know, knowing the mind of God. And I'm wondering now if it's sour grapes because he wasn't able to do that. He's saying, well, there isn't any God anyway.
But what did Jung think about the concept of God and the concept of an afterlife since we're on the topic?
Well, interestingly enough, Jung, he did believe in an afterlife. Well, I said earlier, you know, later on in his career, Jung became more out in the open about all of his occult and paranormal and so on interests and mystical pursuits. And the reason he did was that he had a near-death experience about 1944 when he was about 68. This was the war was still going on, even though Switzerland was neutral. They still suffered a lot of deprivation in the country. And it was winter. He was out taking a walk. He slipped some ice, fell down, broke his leg. And then while he was in hospital, a blood clot developed and he had a heart attack. And then he slipped into a coma. And while he was in that state, he says that he found himself floating, you know, 1,000 miles above the planet, and he could see in the distance the Himalayas, the snow-capped Himalayas, and the sort of sandy wastes of the Arabian desert, and so on. And that he felt, here I'm being, you know, sort of shorn of all my earthly sort of passions and concerns, and he felt he was moving away, and that he had this sort of vision of a kind of this sort of black monolith moving towards him, something sort of a la Stanley Kubrick's 2001.
Oh yeah.
Kind of, and then that becomes a sort of Hindu kind of temple, and there's a Hindu sitting cross-legged in front of it, and there's many, many candles lit. How the candles were lit out in outer space, I don't know. He felt that everyone he knew from his past life that was important to him, that had already died, was waiting for him inside the temple, and that when he went in, you know, the mystery would be revealed to him and all that. And he's just about to enter when hurtling up from the earth, he sees the figure of his doctor. But it's not, he doesn't have the sort of, you know, the band around his head with the shiny disc in the middle of it and the white smock. He's dressed in sort of the archetypal robes of the king of Kos. And Kos was the island in Greek mythology where the god of medicine, Asclepius, lived. And so Jung's doctor, in his archetypal form of the healer and the doctor, is hurtling towards him. And he basically catches up with Carl and he says, look, no, sorry, you have to come back. A lot of people are complaining. It's too early for you to go. You know, the mostly women, they say you should come back to Earth. And Jung said he was extremely disappointed at the news. He didn't want to go back to Earth. He had felt this terrific, you know, sense of freedom and liberation. And that, you know, as I said, the mystery is about to be revealed to him. But, you know, being a doctor and being a responsible individual, he was, you know, persuaded to return. On the return journey, he was concerned about his doctor because he somehow felt that there was something, something very serious about the fact that he had appeared in his archetypal form. And when he came back to consciousness, back in, you know, Switzerland, in the hospital, he was trying to communicate to his doctor and to, you know, the people around him that, you know, his doctor was in danger in some way, but they must have just thought he was raving. You know, he had been in a coma. And but what had happened was that not too long after Jung started to recover, his doctor came down with septicemia and took to his own sickbed and died. But Jung felt chastened by this experience, and he felt that somehow, you know, it was time for him to, you know, just basically put his cards on the table and come out in the open about all this sort of thing. And so, and then even earlier than that, when his sister Gertrude died, he wrote in a letter to someone that what happens after death is so unspeakably beautiful and poignant that we have no conception of it. And this was before his own near-death experience. He doesn't tell us how he knows. But on one level, he's saying, you know, that there is. But in the scientific, when he would put on his Herr Dr. Professor hat, he would have to say, well, you know, there is no evidence and, you know, so on and so on. And he would talk about God in the sense of the God archetype, you know, the archetype of the deity, the archetype of the divine, as something that's part of the human psyche. It's there. It's an irreducible, just as much as we have a liver, you know, or a kidney, and we need to eat or breathe. We have this archetype in our psyche of this divine, I don't know what you want to call it, this kind of being in some way, and that the archetype of the self is related to that. So he sort of Jung, again, this is Jung the scientist saying, I'm not a metaphysician, I'm not a theologian, I'm not saying anything about the objective reality of God. I'm saying that there's an objective reality of God in the sense that there's We have an archetype in the human psyche for God and for the divine. But whether that means that it exists in some way, like, you know, the chair in my room exists, is a different sort of story. But then Jung would also say, as he said late in life, one of the last interviews with him for the television program Face to Face here in the UK in the late 50s, when the interviewer asked him, you know, did he believe in God? Jung said something like, believe? Hard to say. I know. So, so in one sense, there was this Gnostic Jung who believed that he knew, he had knowledge, he had experience of these other spheres. Then the scientist Jung basically saying, well, you know, I'm not talking about some objective. I'm not trying to, you know, step over into the theologian's patch and to start talking about the objective reality of God in the way that theologians do or religious people do and all that. But there certainly is a part of the human psyche that is has this sort of archetypal form. So, you know, he kind of hedged it around. But I think at bottom he did, you know, believe in something more, the divine. Again, it wasn't the God of, you know, the standard sort of, you know, Catholic or Protestant God. You know, Jung was a Gnostic, so his vision of God is very, very different than the kind of, you know, Jehovah figure. And he took that figure to task in one of his last books, the Book of Job, too, where his book is the answer to Job, where he basically comes forth with this Gnostic vision of sort of the God of the Old Testament as being this kind of, a kind of incomplete kind of God that needs to be completed by basically humanity. So that got him in a lot of trouble with, you know, the powers that be.
Right. Now, it's been said that perhaps he was the father of the New Age movement. How would he feel about that?
Well, I think Jung would, again, there'd be a duality. I think he would probably harumph about all of the, you know, New Age sort of namby-pamby, rather soft kind of philosophies that get associated with all of that. And I mean, philosophies is being very generous towards them, using that word. I mean, you know, Jung was an intellectual. He was a scholar. He was a thinker. He was a scientist. So the kind of like easy, you know, easy spirituality that you get with a lot of New Age teachers, I think, would put him off. But and though he always wanted and hankered after the kind of intellectual acceptance that, say, Freud had during Freud's career or late in Freud's career, you know, he was pretty much picked up by the intelligentsia, and his ideas got across into many, many different areas. That even though later in his career that happened to Jung, but he didn't get it as much and as early as he would have liked. I'm sure he would have been very happy by what I called earlier the kind of grassroots, popular sort of dissemination of his ideas. I mean, he's called the father of the New Age because, first of all, he's one of the ones in the 20th century to start talking about the Age of Aquarius, you know, early on. Mm-hmm. As early as 1940, in a letter, he's talking about, you know, the World War II going on and how these events are paralleled in shifts in the stars, and he's talking about the precession of the equinox and, you know, how we're moving into the constellation of Aquarius and so on and so on. So that's pretty early, you know, that gets to be part of the sort of counterculture and popular culture conversation, you know, by the late 60s. You know, it's getting disseminated by the mid-60s in newspapers like the San Francisco Oracle, this underground psychedelic newspaper, and they have astrology column. A guy named Gavin Arthur is talking about the Age of Aquarius. And a couple people earlier than that, it crops up in these esoteric sort of books, but Jung is the one where it starts to become, more broadly disseminated, and then openly in his books, especially the book on UFO he did, UFOs, a myth of modern myth of things seen in the sky, where he's basically saying UFOs are mandalas in the sky. Mandalas are these circular images that the psyche sort of spontaneously creates, and they're also the name for these Tibetan magic circles you see in Tibetan tankas and Tibetan Buddhism, you know, these highly detailed circular sort of meditation sort of symbols. And Jung is saying that this is at the height of the Cold War, the height of the sort of schizophrenic split in the planet between, you know, America on the west and the USSR on the east, and the tensions are rising, and you know we're all heading towards the Cold War is hotting up, and mandalas appear in the psyche in our dreams and in our fantasies and at times of psychic stress, and they're both a way of kind of gauging the state of the psyche at the time, but they're also a kind of goal, a kind of an ideal we project of wholeness. They're an attempt to both depict the state of the psyche at the time, and also in a way to kind of give it a target to move towards, a kind of a more unified sense. Again, there's this notion of the opposites coming together, this sort of bringing the duality together. So Jung is saying with flying saucers is that he sidesteps the question of whether they're, you know, physically real or not, but he says that they seem to serve this function of the collective psyche projecting these images of wholeness. And this has to do, again, with this procession of the equinoxes and us moving into the age of Aquarius and all this kind of thing. But it's all very hush-hush in many ways. He takes a long time getting up to saying it and hedges it about with lots of disqualifiers and so on. So he sort of doesn't want to come right out because he doesn't want to lose or in any way jeopardize this sense of himself or perception of himself as a scientist. And that's, again, that's up to the very end. Another late interview, it's one I start the book with, he's asked, and it's about 1957, I think he's got 4 years left to live. He's asked by the interviewer, you know, are you a mystic, more or less? And Jung says, anybody who thinks I'm a mystic is an idiot, something like that. So, you know, he's, again, it's this constant sort of tension between what he sort of does in practice and says with one hand and with the other. And
what would be the most, I don't know if outlandish is the word, but experiment or piece of research that he did that would make you say, wow, I can't believe that a renowned psychologist would do this. What was the kind of craziest thing Jung ever did?
Well, I mean, that has to be the Red Book that was published, you know, a couple of years ago at the end of 2009, and had been kept secret or hidden or unseen for years. This was Jung's record of the crisis that he went through following the crack up with Freud I mentioned earlier. You know, Freud was a major figure for him, was like a father figure. They had this, you know, kind of father-son relationship, and it cost Jung a lot to have to abandon Freud, to have to give up both his sort of friendship with him and this kind of, you know, father-son relationship. And also he did believe in psychoanalysis. I mean, he, you know, it wasn't just an opportunistic thing for him to support it. He did believe in it. And he would have inherited it. He would have been the big name, you know. But his integrity and his, you know, need to follow his own ideas was greater than that. And so, when he came out with his own work and had to break with Freud, it cost him a lot. And he was cast into the outer darkness. You know, all the Freudians turned against him, you know, in print and in private and so on and so on. And he basically went through this, either you want to call it a kind of spiritual crisis or, you know, the mother of all nervous breakdowns or a psychotic episode. But he started having these visions and waking dreams and finding himself in these trance states and hearing voices and seeing things. And he started to write all these things down in this big leather, you know, book. He just it's called the Red Book just because the cover is red. Another thing that Jung is always saying he's not is an artist. Well, if you've ever seen any of the images, the watercolors that he painted in the Red Book of these mandalas and of these inner figures that he had conversations with and these strange landscapes, you see that, well, he is an artist, whatever he, you know, says about it or not. And then accompanying the paintings are these pages and pages of this minutely detailed calligraphic script of accounts of these visions and dream narratives he found himself in and these kind of inner journeys and so on and so on. And this was something that Jung worked at. Well, he must have started it around 1913. I think a good deck. He sort of the main bulk of it went on for about 5 or 6 years, and then he continued to add to it for years after that. But at the end of it, sometime in the late 20s, when he stopped adding to it, he locked it away in a cupboard in the kitchen in his house.
Mm-hmm.
And in one sense, this was he subsequently. When it's talked about, this is supposed to be the great, you know, work of genius, of, you know, the masterpiece, the whole essence, the foundation of Jung's ideas. And he sort of hemmed and hawed. He didn't know whether to show anybody. I mean, whether people would think he was crazy, you know, or he didn't know whether he was crazy or not. Only a few selected followers around him at the time were allowed to see it. But then he also thought, oh, you know, he kind of wanted it to be more known. So, the dualism comes in where, on the one hand, you have this, and if you see it, it's you know, I don't know if you've seen the images or seen, I mean, they're online, some of them. And
No, I'm not.
You should definitely take a look. I mean, this was a major event, both for Jung's history and also just for publishing itself, because this is one of these books that people knew about and talked about, but no one had ever seen. And then finally, the Jung family, who for years and years and years refused to let, you know, aside from a handful of people, see it, they finally agreed to it being published, edited and published and all that. So it came out, and it's this huge coffee table size book. And it caused a huge stir. I mean, the New York Times, I think, devoted, you know, 6 or 7 pages to it, which is amazing, because New York Times is not particularly on Jung's side, put it that way, and to devote that many pages to it itself tells us that this was a major event. But it's this strange ambivalence, because you have the Jung scholars who worked on it saying this is fantastic, this is a whole gold mine, this is great work, this shows us how he arrived at all of the ideas like introversion and extroversion and the anima and the archetypes and all that. But why did he keep it locked in a cupboard? And then he didn't even leave any provisions for it upon his death. It wasn't in his will saying, like, well, you know, publish it, burn it, whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. It was nothing, it just was left. So again, how you wouldn't think Picasso, you know, there was a Picasso painting that people knew about but no one had ever seen. It was locked away. You'd think he would probably say, okay, look, you know, give it to so-and-so or whatever, the Beethoven's 10th symphony. It's a strange ambivalence and he didn't know what to do with it himself. And one of the reasons I think he didn't know what to do with it is precisely because he was concerned that if people outside his immediate sort of circle, who were more or less like initiates into kind of a secret Jungian sort of society, you know, a more mystical, let's say, approach to Jungian psychology at the time, they might think he was crazy, because it is about talking to figures in his head. He says that he meets these archetypal characters, and they have conversations with him, and he comes to the conclusion that he isn't doing this voluntarily. You know, these beings exist objectively in their own right inside his head. So, but what do you say about a psychiatrist who talks to people in his head? And what would the other psychiatrist say? You know, that
exactly.
So in one sense, it makes sense that he wouldn't tell anybody, but at the same time, it's well. You know what I mean? So
yeah, it seems kind of contradictory.
Well, I mean, if you say what is the craziest thing, I think it would have to be that
absolutely.
Book, because in the scientific writing, you know, the more, you know, main, you know, Jungian texts, he's always in this her doctor professor, you know, mode.
Right.
Mode. So he basically, unfortunately, I think Jung is one of the most important thinkers of the last century, but he was also one of the most obscure, and he expressed his ideas clumsily. Now, it could either be he was a bad writer, or he was ambivalent about it, and so that led to him, you know, trying to say it but not say it at the same time. You know, so it raises all those sorts of questions. I mean, Jung is served very, very well by his followers that sort of wrote about his ideas after him, because they clarified and they presented in forms that are much more accessible than Jung's own writing. And again, you know, this whole process that he went through of this crisis, when he was having these inner conversations. This is a kind of practice that he called active imagination, where you allow these kind of fantasies while you're wide awake. You allow these sort of fantasies to take place, and they kind of turn into these waking dreams, and then you have a dialogue between your conscious mind and your unconscious mind. But the thing I was going to say is that this is one of the most important things he ever developed, but he kept it pretty much a secret. He doesn't really talk about it in all of the collected works. It's mentioned here and there in little tiny places. And it's only the people who came after him that really made it clear. And it's if you go to a Jungian therapist today, it's something that it's up front and they talk about it and it's there. But during Jung's life, he kept it to himself.
But didn't he almost have to do that? Because if he would have come, in some ways, maybe did the word get out more by doing it the way he did it? Because, as you say, if he would have come out front and center with this, he would have been totally obliterated by the establishment. So almost, it's almost like he had to do it kind of in a serpentine way. Hmm. And in some ways, it may have been somewhat brilliant to release it this way, although it took decades for it to come out or be fully fleshed out.
Well, yeah, no, you can say that. But I think it raises the question of, is that a product of Jung's foresight, or is it a product of his prudent concern for his career? I mean, let's say these things are true, you know. Let's agree with Jung that he has discovered something that's of inestimable importance, you know, to understanding ourselves. So does your prudent concern about, like, well, people are going to think I'm crazy if I talk about this, does that outweigh, but it's important and I should spread the word? So I think you have to, you know, look at the questions in that sort of way. And this is one of the things about Jung the mystic with the question mark at the end of it. Around the same time, people with not the same, say, public reputation as he had were talking about these things, but in a more let's say openly esoteric way, like someone like Rudolf Steiner, who I've written about. I mean, Steiner died in 1925, so Jung hadn't quite. I mean, Jung was well known then. He was one of the triumvirate, Freud, Jung, Adler, the three giants of early psychoanalysis. But he hadn't basically come out of the closet yet and become the kind of guru that we know of him now. But Steiner was out there. He's talking about, you know, reading the Akashic record. He's talking about reincarnation. He's talking about you know, having these visions of the etheric bodies and so on and so on. And yes, you're right, he was considered in that case by you know, anybody with the reputation to worry about. But having written a book on Steiner, I think there's a lot there, and there's a lot of parallels between the two of them. And Steiner himself started out not as a scientist in the same way as Jung, but he started out as a scholar and a philosopher. I mean, he wrote books about the German poet Goethe, and he edited his scientific works, and then he wrote books on Nietzsche and so on and so on. So he had he came out of academia and so on. So I don't mean I'm not trying to blame Jung. I'm just trying to say, well, I think, you know, you can't ask these questions. You know, he had a canny side to him where he was sort of looking at things. I mean, another thing was his involvement with National Socialism.
Yes, the idea whether it was a Nazi or not, because
he wasn't a Nazi because he didn't belong to the party, and, you know, he was Swiss, he wasn't German. But the thing was that he did have relations with not the Nazi, you know, hierarchy themselves, but well, basically what had happened was that there was a sort of international psychoanalytic you know, association, but it was centered in Berlin. And when the Nazis came to power, I can't remember his name, but the fellow was the head of it, was Jewish, and they forced him out. And he asked Jung to take over his position precisely because he didn't want psychoanalysis to become this kind of Nazi sort of science, because he knew, you know, gradually or eventually they would get rid of all the non-Nazis and all the Jews out of it, and it would become this German, you know, Nazi German kind of science. And so Jung, being Swiss, not being Jewish, he would be able to stay in it and try to, you know, basically damage control. And then at the same time, he also made some rather injudicious remarks about racial psychology. that were taken up by some of the Nazi hacks and used as evidence of saying, aha, you know, our theories are, you know, corroborated by the great, you know, Dr. Jung of Zurich. And it was a really bad move from at the time, but then Jung was a stubborn character who thought, well, I don't care if people misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not saying the Jews are X, Y, or Z. He's talking about the differences between, you know, racial unconscious and so on. And he talks about the same thing in the context of how he believed Eastern methods of spirituality weren't appropriate for Western psyches. So, but any case, he said the wrong thing at the wrong time in the context of, you know, the wrong people. And this is something that's plagued him throughout his kind of career. So, but at the same time, you know, he was in a position of power, and he wanted to use it. So, you know, you could ask questions about that as well.
Now, I think this is a valuable service to bring this out, because I think sometimes maybe people that are new to the study of the spiritual or the paranormal think that all of this came about when Paranormal State came on the U.S. network A&E, you know, that this is all new, but it's been studied for hundreds and thousands of years in different ways. So I think it's a great service, and you do so much work in this area. Where can folks go on the internet to learn more about this book and about all the other things that you do?
Well, I have a blog. It's garylockman.co.uk, and there's little, you know, info about my other books. There's some excerpts of a new book that's just come out called The Quest for Hermes Trismegistos, which doesn't roll off the tongue trippingly, but he's the he's the legendary founder of alchemy and the hermetic sciences in the West. That's where the hermetic comes from Hermes. It's sort of a history of this figure who was at an earlier time considered a real individual, then subsequently became understood that he was sort of a mythical, a literary figure. And then amazing, because at one time, say during the Renaissance, this character of Hermes Trismegistos means thrice great as Hermes. So he's Hermes who's great, 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 as I think Tony the Tiger used to say about Frosty
right.
Flakes, if I remember my youth correctly. He was considered as important as Jesus or Moses. He was at one point almost made part of the kind of canon of figures in the church and church teaching and all that. And he wasn't. And with the subsequent turn of events, the church became very, very much anti-magic, anti-hermeticism, and the rise of science and rationalism and the kind of reductive approach that I mentioned earlier. He lost his reputation completely, and is pretty much unknown today, aside from people that are interested in sort of the Western esoteric tradition. So it's a book about that, but that character and some of my reflections about what the Hermetic wisdom is. Just a link to Jung. I mean, Jung was very much interested in these Hermetic sciences, and also this experience of gnosis, which is knowledge, this kind of immediate, direct knowledge of reality, rather than the one we acquire through, you know, reason and experiment and gradual kind of putting things together. So yeah, at garylockman.co.uk, you can find out more things about my books, myself, and there's some excerpts and some other things up there as well.
Well, thank you so much for coming to the other side, just like that spiritualist who wanted to get across the road. And we look forward to talking to you in the future about more and more books coming from Gary Lockman. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I'm always happy to join you on the other side.
And thank you for joining us on the other side. We appreciate you being a part of the Plus Club. Hope you'll stay tuned for all of the new and exciting things that we're doing. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.